The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. MyAudiobooks.ai presents Assabet River Town, A Social and Environmental History of Maynard and the Assabet Valley. Prologue. Imagine a crisp autumn morning in 1846 along the banks of the Assabet River in eastern Massachusetts. A man named Amory Maynard stands knee-deep in the shallows, his boots sinking into the mud as the current tugs at his legs. He squints upstream, envisioning not the lazy flow of water through wooded lowlands, but a harnessed force, dams rising, canals carved, and mill wheels churning. The river, dropping steadily over its 34-mile course, whispers of untapped power, yet it mocks him too with its seasonal whims. Swollen in spring, parched in summer. Maynard, a builder schooled in sawmills and construction, grips a surveyor's stake, pounding it into the earth. This bend in the Assabet, he knows, could birth an industry, transforming quiet farmland into a bustling village. But will the river yield, or will it resist, as it has for millennia? This scene unfolds in Middlesex County, roughly 22 miles west of Boston, in a landscape where water has always dictated the rhythm of life. The Assabet River, a modest waterway spanning about 177 square miles of watershed, begins in Westboro and winds northeast to Concord, where it joins the Sudbury to form the Concord River. Its name, rooted in Algonquian languages spoken by the Nipmuc people, might evoke the bends of its path or the nets woven for fishing, fossils of an ancient intimacy with the land. Long before Maynard's ambitions, this valley sustained indigenous communities through the Middle Archaic period, some 5,000 years ago. The Nipmuc, skilled in seasonal subsistence, hunted woodlands, fished streams, and cultivated corn in clearings, reading the river's cycles like a calendar of abundance and scarcity. Enter the colonists, whose arrival in the 1630s brought not just trade, but upheaval. Figures like John Aquitamog, a Nipmuc trader selling maize to desperate Boston settlers, embody those early exchanges, moments of survival amid encroaching claims. Puritan laws reframed the land as parcels to be granted and improved, clashing with Nipmuc views of shared stewardship. Missionary John Eliot's praying towns, like Okomakameset near modern Maynard, aimed to convert and control, while King Philip's War in 1675 shattered communities, scattering survivors and paving the way for deeds that formalized dispossession. Fast forward to Maynard's era, and the river's power draws industrial dreamers. Partnering with William Knight, Maynard dams the Assabet, creating a mill pond to store water against dry spells, a hydraulic system turning natural variability into reliable energy. Their Assabet woolen mill rises, employing hundreds, only to face bankruptcies and rebirths, fueled by civil war demands for union blankets. The village coalesces, incorporating as the town of Maynard on April 19, 1871, with Amory's name etched into its identity. Yet prosperity hinges on fragile threads. Market panics, floods cresting at 8.94 feet, and the eventual shift to synthetics that silences the looms by 1950. Decades later, another visionary arrives. In 1957, Ken Olson, a MIT-trained engineer, rents space in the vacant mill for Digital Equipment Corporation. What begins as modest module sales explodes into the mini-computer revolution, with machines like the PDP-8 democratizing computing. Digital swells to 125,000 employees by 1990, reanimating the brick complex, until mergers and losses in the 1990s empty it once more. At the heart of Maynard's saga lies a profound paradox. A town repeatedly forged and fractured by the same river, its history a cycle of reinvention amid displacement, boom, and bust. How does a place endure when its foundations, water, industry, community, shift like the Assabet's flow? This audiobook invites you to trace that journey from indigenous roots to digital heights and today's hybrid revival, uncovering the resilient spirit that binds past to present. As the river murmurs onward, it beckons us to listen closely. What new chapter will it carve next? End of prologue. Maynard sits in Middlesex County, roughly 22 miles west of Boston. It is close enough to the city's gravity to feel it, but far enough inland. Land that the landscape still sets its own tempo. The town's streets and neighborhoods arrive late in the story. The older presence is water, moving patiently through low ground and rock, doing its work long before anyone calls the place Maynard et Caird. Hydrological surveys profile the Assabet River as a presence that behaves less like a backdrop than a lead character. It begins in Westboro and runs northeast, gathering small streams and wetland seepage, threading through a chain of towns until it reaches Concord. There, it meets the Sudbury River and helps form the Concord River. This is a junction that has always been more consequential than it looks on a map. On paper, the Assabet is about 34.4 miles long. Across that distance, it drops about 220 feet. That is enough fall to tempt anyone looking for power. Its watershed covers about 177 square miles, a catchment big enough to make the river responsive to seasons, storms, and long dry spells. Records from the river gauge in Maynard reveal this yearly rhythm in plain numbers. In spring, flows average over 300 cubic feet per second. The channel becomes full and assertive. In summer, the river often slips under 100 cubic feet per second. It is sometimes so reduced that what looks like a reliable current becomes, for practical purposes, a constraint. Those swings matter because they tell a truth that repeats across the town's history. The Assabet gives generously, but not evenly. Any society that leans on it, whether for food, travel, or machinery, has to adapt to its timing. Long before deeds and town lines, this watershed belongs to deep time. Archaeological assessments date indigenous habitation in this region to the Middle Archaic period, around 5,000 years before the Common Era. The people most closely tied to this inland Massachusetts landscape are the Nipmuc, an Algonquian-speaking people whose communities extend across the central part of the state. In a river system like the Assabet's, subsistence is not a single practice but a seasonal portfolio. Hunting in the surrounding woodlands, fishing in rivers and ponds, and corn cultivation in suitable clearings work together, and each one is reinforced by the others. The river is not simply water to drink or cross. It is a corridor of life that concentrates plants, animals, and human movement, and it helps make the year legible. Even the name Assabet carries that older intimacy, though its exact meaning remains debated. Linguistic studies of Algonquian dialects suggest meanings that include references to materials used for making nets, which is an echo of fishing and river craft. Others suggest it refers to the river's bends and turns, a reminder that the shape of a place can be as important as its size. The uncertainty itself says something. Place names often survive as fossils of use, but they also pass through the distortions of translation, record-keeping, and replacement. What remains is a clue that the river once signified, in language, practical knowledge about how to live along it. The first moments of recorded contact between Nipmuc people and English colonists in this region carry both immediacy and foreboding. Colonial accounts from 1630 record a Nipmuc trader named John Aquitamog selling maize to Boston colonists. The detail is brief in the written record, but the stakes are visible. Corn is not a curiosity in that moment. It is survival. Newcomers, unfamiliar with local growing seasons and food systems, depend on indigenous networks and expertise, even as their settlements begin to press outward. That outward press is not only physical, it is legal and theological, expressed through a Puritan view of land ownership that treats territory as something that can be improved, bounded, and possessed on paper. Indigenous sovereignty does not fit easily into that framework. Where Nipmuc life understands the watershed as shared space shaped by use, kinship, and seasonal return, the Massachusetts Bay Colony increasingly recognizes only what can be granted, bought, sold, and enforced. In practice, the shift turns forests and floodplains into parcels. It creates a widening gap between living on land and owning it. By 1649, that gap has a local mechanism. Records of the General Court detail the 2 mile grant, which allocates land to English settlers, covering portions of what later becomes Maynard. The phrase grant is revealing. A government grants what it assumes it has the right to grant. Once that assumption hardens into routine, it becomes self-justifying, and the map begins to change faster than daily life does. Roads appear, fences multiply, fields widen. The river remains, but the meanings attached to it are being rewritten. Missionary activity adds another layer. It is often described as conversion, but functions just as often as reorganization. Historical accounts from 1654 note that the Puritan missionary John Eliot establishes a praying town settlement called Okomokamesit near the area of the modern wildlife refuge. These communities are intended to gather indigenous converts into English-supervised villages, reshaping religion, law, and daily customs. The stated goal is spiritual transformation. The practical result is surveillance and control, and a narrowing of the space in which Nipmuc communities can maintain autonomy. Then comes rupture on a scale that even decades of encroachment cannot fully prepare a society to absorb. Military histories of King Philip's War, lasting from 1675 to 1676, describe the conflict as catastrophic across New England. It is especially devastating for Nipmuc communities in the interior. In the aftermath, praying Indians are interned on Deer Island in Boston Harbor, where the conditions are brutal and the winter is lethal for many. The survivors are displaced, scattered, and pushed into an increasingly constrained landscape of suspicion and dispossession. The war does not simply end lives, it breaks continuity. It disrupts settlement patterns, governance, and ordinary confidence about where safety can be found. In the decades that follow, dispossession takes on a more administrative face. On March 19th, 1685, a deed of sale records the purchase of native rights for £12. The number is small enough to sound almost symbolic. In a way, it is. Such transactions serve less to compensate than to launder a reality into legality, turning an earlier seizure into a later claim of rightful ownership. Once the paper exists, the burden shifts. Those who remain indigenous on their own land are forced to argue against a document system designed to exclude their assumptions from the start. By the 18th century, colonial surveys describe the area that will eventually become Maynard as farmland and woodlot country. Life is organized around subsistence farming, small-scale animal husbandry, and the steady labor of clearing and maintaining property. Timber matters for heat, for fences, for buildings, and for the countless repairs that make rural life possible. Roads knit the settlements together, but not smoothly. Travel is slow. Hauling goods to market is often the limiting factor, not the ability to produce. Under the administration of neighboring towns, especially Stowe and Sudbury, the region is governed as a set of outlying neighborhoods rather than a coherent center. That arrangement has consequences that sound mundane until they are lived. When a community's footprint is divided between two towns, taxes and schools become a recurring complication. Different rules, different meeting houses, different obligations, and different priorities pull at the same cluster of households. It becomes harder to build shared institutions when the people who would use them do not vote in the same place. Over time, that kind of administrative friction can help create the desire for a new town. This arises not out of romance or rebellion, but out of the persistent inconvenience of being on someone else's margin. Throughout these agricultural decades, the Asabet continues to offer a form of power that does not require horses or human muscle. Property records from the period show small grist and sawmills appearing on the river and its tributaries. These are early expressions of a logic that will later scale up dramatically. Local examples include Puffer Mill and Asa Smith's Mill, modest operations by later standards, but important in what they demonstrate. A mill is not only a building, it is an agreement with a river. Water is diverted, slowed, dropped, and returned. In exchange, grain becomes meal and trees become boards. These mills are also early lessons in the Asabet's variability. A river that can run over 300 cubic feet per second in spring but fall below 100 in summer does not offer uniform output. Work rhythms have to flex. Storage matters. So do mill ponds and the careful timing of water use. Before the railroad, getting products to larger markets depends on routes that are old, imperfect, and sometimes stubbornly beautiful. Old Marlborough Road is part of that pre-industrial infrastructure. It is more than a line on the land. It is a reminder that the landscape's first economy is movement, with people and goods shifting between towns that are close in miles but far in travel time. When roads are muddy, rutted, or seasonally unreliable, the effective distance to market stretches. That fact shapes what kinds of enterprises can survive. It favors what can be used locally and discourages what needs rapid, dependable shipment. Yet the area also holds a kind of magnetism that is not purely economic. In 1851, Henry David Thoreau records journal entries describing walks through this landscape toward Boone's Pond. His attention is not the attention of a surveyor or a deed holder. It is the attention of a person listening for what a place reveals in quiet details. He notes the water level, the plant life, the feel of a path, and the way a town's edges give way to woods and wetland. Thoreau's presence in the record matters because it captures a moment when the Asabet Valley is still largely pre-industrial, even as the wider region is already changing. A landscape can be both lived in and on the brink of transformation, and the journals help make that threshold visible. By the time those walks are put to paper, the underlying logic that will build a mill town is already in place. The Asabet is not a large river, but it has a significant drop, about 220 feet over its length. That is a form of stored energy waiting to be converted. At the same time, the river's seasonal swings, from spring abundance to summer restraint, make it a complicated partner. Anyone who imagines industry here has to imagine control. They must build dams, canals, and mill ponds, and they must negotiate rights to water and schedules shaped by flow. The river invites speculation precisely because it is both promising and demanding, offering power to those willing to engineer around its moods. As engineering turns from small mills to a full industrial wager, the harnessing of the Asabet's drop prepares Asabet Village to become Maynard in everything but name. In the middle of the 19th century, the Asabet stops being merely a river with mills on it. It becomes, in a literal sense, a machine. That change begins with a partnership between two men who understand that water power is not something that happens naturally. It is something that gets built. Biographical records note that Amory Maynard is born on February 28, 1804. By the time he turns toward the Assabet Valley, he is already fluent in the practical disciplines that make industrial towns possible. Historical accounts of his early career describe experience in construction and sawmill management, work that teaches measurements, load, and timing. It teaches the difference between a plan that looks right and a plan that holds. He partners with William Knight, and together they move from using water to reshaping it. Engineering plans from 1846 and 1847 show that Maynard and Knight dam the Assabet River. A dam is a statement. It means the river will no longer decide on its own terms when power is available. The most visible outcome is the mill pond, created as part of a larger hydraulic system that includes a canal and the infrastructure needed to deliver controlled water to turbines. The pond is not only scenic, it is stored energy, held in reserve against the Assabet's variability. In spring, the river can run high and fast. In summer, it can shrink to something closer to a constraint than a resource. A mill pond and canal are ways of turning those moods into something steadier. Water is impounded, diverted, and released through gates. The mill complex is designed around that controlled drop, with power transferred inward to machinery that does not care about weather so long as the head of water holds. Out of that engineered landscape comes the Assabet Woolen Mill, an enterprise that begins with one product line and quickly discovers how exposed manufacturing is to markets it cannot command. Tax valuations from 1848 place the operation at $150,000. This figure signals ambition and heavy investment, but it also signals vulnerability. Mills of this era are capital-intensive. Their finances are often built on borrowed money, extended terms, and confidence that next season will resemble the last. Note that financial details presented here are for historical context, not investment advice. Financial histories of the era reveal that the panic of 1857 reaches directly into local lives. After that panic, the mill goes bankrupt. For workers, bankruptcy is not an abstract event. It is unpaid wages, lost jobs, and families improvising in a place that has begun to depend on the mill's payroll. For owners and investors, it is the sudden realization that water power and brick cannot guarantee solvency. The same canal that makes production possible cannot keep demand from collapsing. What changes the mill's trajectory is war, specifically the kind of war that turns textiles into military necessity. Corporate records from 1862 show the enterprise reorganizing as the Assabet Manufacturing Company. The new corporate name signals a fresh start, but the deeper shift is strategic. The production focus pivots to wool blankets and flannel for the Union Army. This is not merely a switch in inventory, it is a move into a market where volume is enormous and urgency overrides hesitation. Procurement for an army does not behave like household consumption, it accelerates time. Wartime production scales quickly. Workforce rosters from this period describe employment growing to over 2,000 people. That number, in a valley that has recently been farmland and woodlot country, is a demographic event as much as an economic one. It means shifts and noise at hours that do not match agricultural rhythms. It means boarding houses, tenements, and the steady traffic of deliveries. It also means that the mill is no longer just a large employer in a rural corner. It is the organizing institution around which a village coheres. The built environment changes to match that new role. Brick mill buildings rise, and with them comes a distinctive visual identity that still defines the town's center. Brick is not chosen only for appearance, it is chosen for fire resistance, durability, and the ability to span large floor plates with repetitive windows that admit light to rows of machinery. These buildings announce permanence. They make the industrial wager legible in architecture and they concentrate it in a compact downtown where water, power, labor, and transport converge. As the mill complex gains mass, civic life begins to reorganize around it. A mill of this scale pulls in people who need places to live, worship, and gather. Housing follows work. Churches follow housing. Shops follow the daily needs of a population that cannot, in practical terms, travel far for basics. Over time, the settlement becomes a village with its own gravity, increasingly distinct from the parent towns of Sudbury and Stowe. The administrative friction that once felt like a minor inconvenience now feels like a structural mismatch. A community oriented around a single industrial center begins to want a single civic identity to match it. That desire turns into formal politics in 1870. Legislative petitions from that year show residents seeking recognition that the village has become something the older town boundaries no longer describe. The process takes time, because incorporation is not only a declaration of identity, it is a redistribution of land, tax base, and support. And responsibility. The outcome is precise. The town of Maynard is officially incorporated on April 19, 1871. Records of the separation describe payments of about $23,600 to Sudbury and $8,000 to Stowe. Such numbers matter because they show that independence is negotiated, not merely proclaimed. They also underscore that the new town is not a small offshoot. At incorporation, Maynard has 1,820 residents. It is instantly larger than its parent towns. Population, here, is political power. Amory Maynard remains central to the town's industrial life long after his name becomes municipal fact. Obituaries confirm he dies on March 5, 1890, closing the life of the man whose personal chronology is braided into the town's early decades. By that year, mill valuation reaches $1.5 million. Compared to the $150,000 valuation in 1848, the difference is not only growth. It is a measure of how thoroughly the river has been converted into output. Yet the story of a mill town is rarely a straight ascent. Industrial success tends to produce its own pressures, including the need for constant reinvestment and exposure to commodity prices. Even at its apex, a mill's prosperity rests on a balancing act between labor costs, energy costs, and markets that can shift with startling speed. In Maynard, the next marker of legacy is both civic and mechanical. Municipal archives record that in 1892, Lorenzo Maynard gives the town a clock tower featuring an E. Howard and Company mechanism. The gift reads as commemoration, but it also functions as infrastructure. A clock is a public standard. It coordinates work and civic life. It asserts that this is a place with a center, a shared time, and a public face. Then, in 1898, the balance breaks. Court filings from that year detail the bankruptcy of the mill. The human cost is especially sharp because worker savings are implicated. Accounts of the period describe savings held by the company, a practice that can arise in towns where formal banking is limited, and the employer becomes, by default, a financial intermediary. When the company fails, those deposits are no longer secure. The loss is not only economic, it changes trust. It alters how families interpret the bargain they have made with an institution that is both employer and, in practice, keeper of their money. The following year, in 1899, corporate consolidation arrives as a solution. Deeds of sale show the American Woolen Company acquiring the complex. Ownership shifts from local figures to a larger enterprise that can spread risk across multiple sites and pursue scale. For the town, this means the mills continue, but the decision-making center moves outward. The river still turns wheels, but the strategy is set by people who may not live within sight of the mill pond. In the early 20th century, census data reveals the mill's labor force becoming a map of migration. Waves of arrival from Finland, Poland, Russia, and Italy shape neighborhoods and social life. The details vary family by family, but the overall pattern is clear. Industrial towns in Massachusetts pull in workers from abroad, and those workers build institutions that carry language, foodways, faith traditions, and mutual aid. Streets take on reputations connected to who lives there. The result is not a vague melting pot, but a town with distinct social circuits that help newcomers find work and housing in a demanding industrial environment. Modernization follows the logic of density. Transportation archives record the start of electric trolley service in 1901. A trolley is more than transportation. It is a sign that the town's daily movement has outgrown footpaths and horse-drawn routines. That same year, construction records describe the building of 160 worker tenements. These are purpose-built multifamily housing units intended to keep labor close to the mills. They are a reminder that industrial prosperity produces a particular kind of built form that is compact, efficient, and shaped by the imperative of proximity. 1901 also brings one of the most striking additions to the mill complex, Building Number 5. Industry journals report it as the largest woolen mill building in the world at the time of its completion. Even without embellishment, the claim conveys scale. A building of this size is not built for local demand alone. It is built for national and international markets. It assumes contracts that require continuous operation and relies on a company confident that wool will remain central to American industrial supply. But the Assabet, which has been disciplined into a power source, never stops being a river with its own hazards. Meteorological accounts of 1927 document floodwaters destroying the Waltham Street Bridge. A bridge failure is an infrastructure crisis in miniature. A daily route disappears, commerce detours, and the physical connection between neighborhoods becomes uncertain. For a mill town, it is also a reminder that the same water that powers the machinery can, in the wrong conditions, threaten the very structures built along its banks. By the middle of the century, industry reports track forces beyond the Assabet Valley, tilting the entire sector. The decline of New England textiles is not caused by a single event, but by a compound shift. Production moves to the south, where operating costs are often lower. Simultaneously, the rise of synthetics changes what consumers buy. Wool, once central, becomes less dominant. Competition ceases to be local or even regional. It becomes structural. Local newspapers from 1950 announce the final shutdown. For a town built around a single industrial heartbeat, a shutdown is not a normal business downturn. It is a rupture in identity and municipal finance. The brick buildings remain, massive and central, but they no longer perform their intended function. In the early 1950s, the complex stands largely vacant. It is an empty citadel of manufacturing in the middle of downtown. The threat is existential because the mill is not on the edge of town. It is the town's center of gravity. As the looms fall silent, the brick citadel waits for a new tenant that deals in signals rather than wool. In the late 1950s, the brick mass of the old woolen mill still dominates downtown Maynard, but it no longer has a purpose that matches its scale. The looms are gone. The clatter that once set the town's daily rhythm has faded into an architectural afterimage of long rows of windows, a clock tower that keeps time for empty rooms, and a river sliding past, indifferent to what humans make of it. Then, on August 27th, 1957, a new kind of tenant steps into Building 12. Corporate records describe Digital Equipment Corporation, founded that year by Ken Olson and Harlan Anderson, as renting roughly 9,000 square feet for $300 a month. The details matter because they show how modest the wager is at the start. A mill complex built to employ thousands becomes, for a moment, an affordable shell for a handful of engineers trying to turn ideas into hardware. The company's origin story, like many in post-war technology, begins with expertise, but not with abundance. In 1957, American Research and Development provides a $70,000 investment in exchange for 70% equity. That arrangement reads starkly now, but it captures the era's uncertainty. Computing is not yet a familiar consumer industry. It is a specialized field tangled in government research and university labs, and a young firm looks less like the future than a risk that might never find enough customers. What makes digital's first year so revealing is that the proof arrives not in grand visions, but in sales receipts. In its first year, corporate accounts show roughly $94,000 in module sales, and the company is profitable. These modules are electronic building blocks designed to be combined into larger systems. Profit in year one is more than a financial milestone. It is validation that a market exists for reliable, standardized parts in a world where many machines are still one-off creations. It also explains why Maynard becomes the setting for a second industrial era. The town already has what factories need in space, power infrastructure, and a workforce that understands precision manufacturing. Digital's rise is often described as a revolution in machines, but it is also a revolution in accessibility. Mainframe computers, the giants of the early industry, tend to be expensive, centralized, and controlled by specialists. The minicomputer changes the social arrangement by bringing computing power into laboratories, hospitals, and university departments that could never justify a mainframe. The word mini can mislead. These are not toys. They are transformative precisely because they fit into more places, serving more tasks with fewer layers of permission. The early products make Maynard's name travel. The PDP-5 begins to establish the company's reputation. Then, in 1965, the PDP-8 arrives and becomes one of the machines most closely associated with the mini-computer era. In corporate product histories, the PDP line is described as an inflection point. It is capable enough to matter, affordable enough to spread, and standardized enough to support an ecosystem of users. In practical terms, that means the mill complex is no longer a relic of textile capitalism. It becomes a node in a new geography of innovation that runs through Massachusetts and far beyond it. As digital grows, it expands through the same physical logic that once defined the woolen mill. Industry does not only scale through ideas, it scales through floor space, loading docks, and the dull reliability of buildings that can hold heavy equipment. Property deeds from 1974 record digital buying the entire mill complex, including the dam and pond. This is a striking turn in the town's long story with water. In the 19th century, the Assabet is engineered into stored power for wool. In the 20th, the same complex now anchors a company built on signals, logic, and silicon. Ownership of the site is a declaration that the company plans to stay, and that Maynard is not merely a convenient stopgap. The river, however, never lets industry forget its older rules. Flooding is part of the Assabet's character, and local gauge records give that threat a numeric spine. In 1955, the Assabet reaches a record crest of 8.94 feet. The figure is easy to read as an abstract measurement until it is paired with the landscape of water pressing toward basements, roads, and the lowest edges of a downtown built tightly along the channel. The same river that offers power also asserts that containment is conditional. In the years that follow, flood control infrastructure begins to change the terms of that relationship. Meteorological accounts of later floods describe control dams helping mitigate major events in 1968 and 1979. Mitigation does not mean the river becomes harmless. It means the most destructive peaks are blunted, giving towns downstream a better chance of keeping buildings dry. For employers whose machinery and inventory sit behind brick walls only a short distance from the waterline, the long arc of local engineering continues, even as what happens inside the buildings shifts from textiles to circuit boards. By the late 1970s, digital enters a new phase that accelerates headcount, revenue, and global footprint. In 1977, the company launches the VAX 11780. In corporate histories, the VAX era is treated as the engine of massive expansion. A successful platform becomes a magnet that draws customers who build their operations around it. It draws skilled workers who want to be near the action, and it draws a halo of secondary businesses that depend on the primary one. By 1990, Digital reports roughly 125,000 employees and $14 billion in sales. Those figures are not just a corporate boast. They are a reminder of how thoroughly a single firm can reorder the destiny of a small town. Maynard's earlier industrial peak is visible in records of over 2,000 textile workers in the Civil War years. Digital's numbers operate on a different scale, and while much of that workforce is distributed around the world, the symbolism remains local. The mill complex is now associated with the rise of a company that helps define an era of computing. Yet the most durable lesson in Maynard's economic history is that dominance does not grant immunity. Industrial systems are exposed to forces that do not care about local pride, including shifts in technology, competition, and cost. The same brick buildings that once sat at the mercy of textile markets now sit under the shadow of a different kind of churn, one that moves at electronic speed. In 1991, layoffs begin. The human meaning of a layoff is always specific to mortgages and careers, but the civic meaning is broader. A town that has oriented itself around a major employer begins to feel the ground shift beneath its assumptions. The following year, in 1992, Ken Olsen resigns. Leadership changes can be framed as strategy, but in a period of contraction, they also function as public markers that the era of steady ascent has ended. By 1993, mill operations cease. For Maynard, that phrase carries a double weight. The buildings go quiet again, just as they did when American Woolen shut down in 1950. Financial filings capture the nadir in a single stark line. A $183 million loss reported in April 1994. Losses of that magnitude constrain choices. They reduce the room for long-term bets and force asset sales that can feel like an erosion of identity. The numbers explain why the endgame becomes less about reinvention inside Maynard and more about consolidation at a national scale. That consolidation becomes formal on June 1, 1998, when merger documents detail Compaq acquiring Digital for $9.6 billion. 4 years later, on May 3, 2002, Hewlett-Packard acquires Compaq. With that second acquisition, Digital's corporate lineage continues, but its distinct presence in Maynard's mill complex has already ended. The town does not lose its history, but it loses the belief that one employer can anchor a whole community for a generation without interruption. If the first half of Maynard's story is about building an industrial town around water power, the second half becomes a study in what happens after the signature industry leaves. The question is not merely economic. It is a question of what a town does with a massive complex of brick and steel at its literal center when the payroll that once justified it has vanished. Real estate records from 1998 show Wellesley Management beginning to operate the mill complex as Clock Tower Place. The change is subtle in one sense and dramatic in another. Instead of a single enterprise with a unified mission, the property becomes a managed ecosystem of tenants. That shift spreads risk and changes the daily feel of the place. A one-company campus has a single rhythm, while a multi-tenant complex has overlapping schedules and a more varied relationship to downtown. Ownership changes again in 2015, when the Mill and Main partnership acquires the site. Development filings describe major upgrades completed by 2017. The timeline is important because it signals intention backed by capital. Adaptive reuse is not a sentimental act. It requires engineering, financing, and the slow work of making old industrial space desirable for new uses. In Maynard, the reuse is the central project because the Mill complex is the downtown's anchor and its most visible inheritance. Outside the brick walls, the Assabet itself enters a new phase of public meaning. For much of Maynard's past, the river is treated as power, risk, or obstacle. In the contemporary period, it also becomes recreation and stewardship. Municipal planning documents valuate the Assabet River Rail Trail at roughly $6 million. A rail trail is not just a path. It is a statement about how the town imagines movement and connection in a post-industrial landscape. It threads through a corridor once optimized for freight and repurposes it for walkers, runners, and cyclists. Stewardship organizations add another layer of continuity. OARs, the Organization for the Assabet, Sudbury, and Concord Rivers, runs monitoring programs and, in 2025, continues invasive water chestnut management. The details of that work can be unglamorous, but the underlying idea is significant. A river that was once treated primarily as industrial input is now treated as a living system with recreational and environmental value. Numbers from the contemporary town sharpen the picture. Census data places the population at approximately 10,526. The median household income sits at about $90,134. These figures describe a community that is no longer a classic factory town, and not a single-company technology hub either. It is something more hybrid, a Boston-area town with a distinctive downtown, a recognizable industrial architecture, and an economy that depends on a mix of local businesses and commuters. That hybrid identity has its constraints, and one of the most consequential is water. A water supply master plan from December 2025 highlights limits on new development. In a town built around a river, the limiting factor is not the existence of water in the landscape, but the capacity of the systems that treat and deliver it. Infrastructure sets the ceiling on growth more firmly than ambition does. In practical terms, limits on supply can delay projects that would otherwise be straightforward, turning the slow mechanics of wells and treatment into the decisive variable in housing planning. Housing pressure is not abstract here, because Maynard sits within the gravitational field of the Boston region's real estate market. Rising prices in the wider area can turn a small town into a pressure vessel, increasing demand for both home ownership and rentals. Civic debates then cluster around familiar questions of how to add housing without losing character, and how to keep a community livable when regional economics push relentlessly outward. One emblem of that tension appears in schooling and housing policy. The stalled conversion of the Fowler School is not just a local planning story. It is a demonstration of how modern constraints differ from older ones. In the textile era, the limiting factor might be power or labor. In the high-tech era, it might be product cycles. In today's Maynard, an old building's future can hinge on the practicalities of municipal capacity. Against those pressures, downtown revitalization becomes a strategy as much as a mood. Maynard's cultural economy, expressed through art space and art walk, signals a deliberate turn toward placemaking. In a post-industrial town, culture is a way of keeping the center active and maintaining a sense that the downtown is more than a corridor people pass through. The brick buildings help here by providing a setting with authenticity that newer developments often try to imitate. Maynard does not need to manufacture character. It has it in the windows, the clock tower, and the pond that holds the river's controlled pause. Through all these transformations, the deepest continuity is not any single product, so much as the town's habit of reinvention under constraint. Maynard is repeatedly forced into the same hard task of absorbing an economic shock and finding a new use for an old landscape. The river remains the through line, sometimes threatening, sometimes enabling, but increasingly cared for as an asset rather than merely endured as a force. Maynard's defining pivot moves from wool to Watts to a modern, mixed-use town along the Assabet, still shaped by the river's timing and finding, in old brick and moving water, the materials for a new chapter. Thank you for choosing myaudiobooks.ai.